And welcome everyone to the Virtual Court of Appeals for December 17. I'll ask the marshal to first introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Gaitas, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Randall Sleater presiding.
And we do have three matters on our oral calendar today, and then we will have three non-oral matters to consider afterwards. The first matter is A-20-0906, the Special School District Number 1, Minneapolis Public Schools as the appellant versus Minnesota Federation of Teachers. And though we're virtual, everything else should be pretty much what council are familiar with or would expect in terms of the protocol. Appellants counsel will have 15 minutes to present argument, respondents counsel 15 minutes to respond, and then 5 minutes for appellants counsel as rebuttal. You'll see a box right now that's mostly white with small numbers, but that will be much enlarged when we start so that you can see the time. If for some reason, though, we lose you, especially the audio, most importantly, we will stop, the marshal will stop the clock until we can get our connection fixed. We haven't had any difficulties of late, so knock on wood, that'll continue to be the case. Also, we do prohibit recording of the proceeding. This matter is recorded pursuant to the usual policy of the judicial branch and will be available on the branch's website within the next 24 hours or so. So any additional or other alternative recording methods are all prohibited. And so, counsel for appellant, and I do ask each counsel to identify yourselves when you begin your argument. So, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Margaret Skelton and I represent Minneapolis Public Schools. Your Honors, the agreement was laid off effective 2010. By her own testimony, she did not retire. 7 years later in 2017, she brought a grievance demanding a retirement benefit from Minneapolis Public Schools. After an arbitration, the grievance was sustained. We're here today on an exceedingly rare occurrence, a public sector labor arbitration award that must be vacated pursuant to 572B.23 because the arbitrator exceeded his authority. Minneapolis Public Schools acknowledges that judicial deference is given to arbitration awards, but such deference is not unlimited, and there are limitations to an arbitrator's authority. In this highly unusual case, we're asking the court to vacate the arbitration award on four different bases because the arbitrator exceeded the arbitrator's authority. First, as acknowledged by the trial court, the arbitrator made an improper constitutional determination. It's clear under case law, County of Hennepin versus LALS and McGrath versus State, that the arbitrator had no authority to make a constitutional determination. The trial court erred in two ways by finding that the constitutional determination was not necessary to the award. First, it's very clear under 572B.23 that an award must be vacated if the arbitrator exceeds his authority. And it's clear under case law, the arbitrator exceeded his authority by making a constitutional determination.
Second. Ms. Kelton, could I just inquire on that point? It seems there's no dispute by the parties that that was an improper portion of the arbitrator's decision. But I did not see any case law that you could point us to that would suggest that by referencing or issuing a constitutional decision that was improper, that as a per se matter, the entire decision should be considered exceeding the powers. And so that's my question is, could not and did not the arbitrator continue to go on by interpreting the contract itself in addressing the issue separate from the constitutional issue?
In the case of County of Hennepin, the court said, County of Hennepin versus LALS, that the court indicated that an arbitrator's constitutional determination is only reviewable on the basis that the arbitrator exceeded his authority, Your Honor. So there is case law to suggest that because the arbitrator exceeded his authority, that the arbitration award must be vacated. And secondly, Your Honor, the constitutional determination really infected the entire award. Because of the constitutional determination, the arbitrator determined that there was a requirement for a notice to the grievant. And without that notice, Minneapolis Public Schools violated due process. This notice requirement for a termination of a benefit, and really the benefit wasn't terminated. She wasn't eligible for the benefit because she did not retire, but a termination of the benefit as determined in the award, that notice requirement is nowhere in the language of the collective bargaining agreement and was purely created because the arbitrator made an improper constitutional determination. Your Honor, the arbitration award also must be vacated because it's because the arbitrator adjudicated a grievance that he didn't have the authority to adjudicate. And under Ide versus State Farm, that is another basis where the arbitrator exceeded his authority. The collective bargaining agreement in this case is very clear that a grievance shall not be valid for consideration unless submitted in writing within 20 days after the event giving rise to the grievance. The event giving rise to the grievance in this case was the non-receipt of the wellness pay. The grievant would have received wellness pay at the time that she left employment in 2010. And after she failed to receive it, she had 20 days from that time period to grieve this matter.
Well, counsel, aren't we required to defer to the findings of the arbitrator about what the triggering event was as well, just applying our standard of review? And wasn't the district court required to do that too?
So the arbitrator cannot manifestly disregard the language of the collective bargaining agreement. And doing so is considered exceeding the arbitrator's authority. And in Ide versus State Farm, the court discussed the fact that in exercising the court's de novo review, the court must determine if the arbitrator exceeded his authority. And to do that, the court is going to, in a limited extent, need to examine the language of the arbitration agreement and other admissible evidence, including facts and the law. And so appellant agrees that your review is limited, but there is still going to be some need to be some review of the facts and law in order to determine whether the arbitrator exceeded his authority. In this case, the arbitrator exceeded the plain language of the collective bargaining agreement, limiting grievances to 20 days within the time of the event. And he did so by saying that, you know, she retired in 2010, and that wasn't the triggering event when she did not receive wellness pay. Her recall rights ended in 2012. That wasn't the triggering event when she didn't receive wellness pay. The union became aware of this grievance in 2016, both when Minneapolis Public Schools told the grievant that she wasn't going to receive wellness pay, and the grievant told the union, and that's at addendum 26, that she wasn't going to receive wellness pay, but that the grievance process only begins to run when the union specifically asks about an event and there is a response from the district. We've cited El-Khoury and El-Khoury, which specifically address this issue and which the courts frequently cite in grievance arbitrations, that the trigger for a grievance timeline is the individual grievance knowledge of the conduct, not the union's later knowledge of the event. And the union's later knowledge does not extend the timeline of the grievance. Here the arbitrator effectively abolished the 20-day window timeline for filing a grievance, allowed an employee that had not been an employee for Minneapolis Public Schools for 7 years to come forward and bring a grievance. And under that rationale, any employee gone 20 years, 30 years, can come forward. And if the union asks about the specific issues involving those employees, that grievance is now timely. manifestly disregarding the language of the collective bargaining agreement, limiting grievances to 20 days. In this case, a statute of limitations.
I'm just wondering if you could, the arbitrator here did address the constitutional issue. I think was really analyzing a fairness issue couched in constitutional terms. And I'm just wondering if, to sort of deepen my understanding of your argument, you might walk us through what would typically happen with wellness pay under the collective bargaining agreement in ordinary circumstances. In other words, when someone separates from the Minneapolis public schools, do they just go on their way, and are they never notified of the wellness pay, or was this truly an unusual situation?
Thank you, Your Honor. So this was a bit unusual because the grievant had lower seniority than other employees. But typically what happens is employees are frequently laid off from Minneapolis public schools because of declining enrollment, either in the class or in the district. At the time of layoff, the employee makes a determination whether they're going to wait for their recall rights, or they can decide to retire at that time. In this case, the grievant, by her own testimony, did not retire. If she had retired, she would have been eligible for the wellness benefits. She could have waited the 2 years for her recall rights to expire. At that time, she could have tried to retire from Minneapolis Public Schools and sought her wellness benefit at that time. The issue in this case is that she never retired. She needs to notify Minneapolis Public Schools that she is retiring. And the language of the wellness pay in the collective bargaining agreement indicates that it's available to teachers who are retiring. And so, because she did not retire, and there is a misconception that somehow Minneapolis public schools can avoid paying the wellness pay by laying employees off, and that is not true. After employees are laid off, they have the opportunity to retire. And frequently, employees do retire, and then they are eligible for wellness pay. The issue in this case was that the grievant did not retire. And so she did not become eligible for wellness pay. And by her own testimony, she did not intend to retire. She didn't want to retire.
Ms. Skelton, to follow up Judge Gaeta's question, though, the arbitrator and the district court in affirming it, really primarily the arbitrator, focused on the eligible to retire. Isn't it reasonable that if it was clearly intended to be retired, it would so state? But being eligible to retire obviously has a clearly different meaning, as the arbitrator pointed out. Doesn't require retirement, in other words, and she was clearly factually eligible but chose not to.
So if you look at the 2009 2011 collective bargaining agreement, she still has to retire. Teachers retiring, if you look at the 11-13 collective bargaining agreement, the language on wellness pay, it indicates that she's entitled to the wellness pay following the end of the school year during which they retired. And the arbitrator in this case ignored those four words, during which they retired. In his award, he quoted the language from the 2011-2013 CBA wellness pay and left off those four key words, during which they retired.
But didn't the arbitrator read it? And again, we give deference to how the interpretation of the arbitrator is, that in fact, till she retires, the retired happened in 2016 or after the 2016 year. So again, that's just an interpretation the arbitrator make. How would we be able to conclude from those words, even if we disagreed with that interpretation, that it exceeded the arbitrator's power?
So the arbitrator left off words from the collective bargaining agreement. He quoted the language from the collective bargaining agreement and left off four key words. The arbitrator authority is only determined by the arbitration agreement. And pursuant to the arbitration agreement, Article 13, Subdivision 4, the arbitrator does not have the power to add to, subtract from, or modify in any way the existing terms of the contract. And so in this case, the arbitrator left off four words of the language. And this was very key because then the arbitrator said, nothing in the contract says that the employee who is eligible to retire must declare she is retiring. And in fact, it does say during which they retired. And because the leaving off those words in the collective bargaining agreement, the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the language of the collective bargaining agreement. When you couple the unlimited timeline to grieve and providing wellness pay benefits to employees that do not retire, this opens up enormous liability for Minneapolis Public Schools and is inconsistent with the language of the collective bargaining agreement.
So just make sure, I have a question on that. Is it your view then that there never was an event, or that there was an event that was so long ago the grievance wasn't timely filed?
Both, Your Honor. So there never was an event in the sense that she never retired, and that's not disputed in the record. She did not retire while she had any connection to Minneapolis Public Schools. She didn't retire at the time of her layoff. She didn't retire at the time of her recall.
So she's both too early and too late.
She didn't retire under the collective bargaining agreement. And then when she sought to grieve the retirement 7 years later, it was beyond the 20-day time frame that she could bring a grievance.
Okay. I see we've run out of time, and my lights automatically went off in this office, so I'm going to step away for a second. Oh. And then they magically went on. I guess I just wasn't mobile enough during the conversation.
That's the magic of Judge Rodenberg. We'll note for the record, and Ms. Skelton, you'll of course have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and counsel for respondent, you may now introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Deb Korhouse, and I work at Education Minnesota, and I'm representing the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, the respondent in this matter. And Your Honor, I want to just start off right from the bat to address the questions that you posed to appellant and to clarify some things. Ms. Skelton was saying at the very end here that the arbitrator left off four important words during which she retired. And I just want to clarify that that phrase impacted when the payment was to be made. So it had nothing to do with eligibility, like Your Honor stated. So the arbitrator determined she was eligible. She provided the separation form that the district required, and then she requested that payment, which was then denied, and that was the denial that was grieved from.
Is it your view then that during which they retired relates to the verb contributed?
Exactly, Your Honor. Because this payment is made, and for even people that retire on a normal cycle, they don't get the payment until much later. It's not immediate upon the retirement. So this is addressing when that payment is made to the healthcare savings plan. And the arbitrator determined that retirement was to be determined by when they retired from teaching as a whole, so through the teacher's retirement system, not retired from a particular district. So that was also part of the arbitrator's holdings. And again, like you've all stated, that's within the arbitrator's purview to decide. I also wanted to clarify, and again, I don't want to overemphasize this because we're getting into facts that were for the arbitrator, but there is absolutely nothing in the record that says there were no other examples of anyone who was laid off and given an option to retire. And to say that the district would have allowed her to retire after her recall rights expired is completely inconsistent with the record. We were told at hearing that the only time she would have been allowed to retire and collect benefits would have been had she thought to retire before the board acted. That was the only window that was provided at hearing. And district witnesses themselves, when inquired about what would have been a trigger, even the district's own witness said a trigger is a denial. So for them to recreate the record right now, I think is inappropriate.
Ms. Kourhouse, can I just jump you to the issue of arbitrability, because both parties seem to have briefed that significantly. My first question to you is, do you believe there is or was an actual issue of arbitrability? In other words, I understand from the briefs and the way the arbitrator understood it, the parties did not dispute that the issue of the wellness pay denial was arbitrable. So I'm assuming from that, there's really not an issue, or was not, for the arbitrator in terms of interpretation of 572B06 B, and in particular the change that referenced an exception to the court making that determination when the CBA is involved.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. The parties understood that this was the purview of the arbitrator. The district made no motion to the court or didn't require us to compel arbitration. They understood they were obligated to arbitrate it, and they did so. And now that the Uniform Arbitration Act provides that that's within the purview of the arbitrator, the court's review is limited to whether or not he exceeded his powers. It's not a de novo review as counsel would request.
Can I just clarify then? I assume, however, the issue of whether the arbitrator exceeded power or authority as it relates to timeliness, and even though we defer factually and legally, and we've already discussed that with Ms. Skelton, that's an unrelated issue. So in other words, we're not precluded from reviewing that issue, if I understand correctly. Your point being is that, of course, we defer to the arbitrator's interpretation of the contract and the 20 days and simply find there's no exceeding of authority. Did I summarize your position on that?
Your Honor, I think you're right. I would say the district court assessed it in both ways. One is, now that this is clearly within the arbitrator's authority, I don't need to review that. That's the arbitrator's decision. So she made a finding on that. She also said, even if I were to review it, he didn't exceed his authority, right? He looked to the contract, made an assessment of based on the evidence he received, based on the law of the shop that's allowed in arbitration, and made this conclusion. There was no personal notion of justice. He didn't manifestly disregard the agreement. He used the agreement. So I think this court could look at it both ways, or either way.
Well, perhaps maybe that's what led me to a confusion, because again, I didn't see an issue of either party suggesting that the wellness pay is not arbitrable. And it seems to me that ends the analysis of the statutory reference to the CBA and so forth. In other words, maybe to say it differently, if hypothetically the CBA prohibited an arbitrator from arbitrating, or from the parties from arbitrating the wellness pay, and yet the arbitrator did so, I assume we could still, under the exceeding power or authority, review that and reverse it for that reason. Am I summarizing overall the law as you understand it, Ms. Kourhouse?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I would just also add that I think there are two types of arbitrability at issue here. I think you've talked about the substantive arbitrability regarding the wellness pay itself, but counsel has also raised two different kinds of procedural arbitrability. So she's one saying it wasn't timely because we waited for the denial to grieve it the first time we had notice of it. And secondly, that somehow the union doesn't have the ability to enforce its own contract. So she's also saying the grievant could not be someone who is separated. She's not allowed to challenge this denial or this loss of a benefit. So there's those multiple levels of arbitrability that are in play. Those were both issues that were raised with the arbitrator, and the arbitrator decided on those issues. And so then, yes, I think it would be subject to the standard about whether or not he drew his essence of his decision from the agreement.
Ms. Korhaus, you agree that the arbitrator exceeded his authority in addressing a constitutional issue, right?
I would frame it a little differently, Your Honor. I would say that the parties did not ask him to review that issue, but that he didn't actually make a determination on the Constitution. He made constitutional comments, references that were parallel to his decision on the merits. So he first found it was arbitrable. Then he found under the contract, this was the district had a duty to pay her and failed to follow that duty, and therefore violated the contract. And then he also said, by the way, this was a violation of her due process rights because she didn't have any notice that this would happen. So, please go ahead.
So I was just going to ask if you could address, given your position, that this was just sort of a side note, Ms. Skelton's argument that indeed the impermissible due process finding of the arbitrator actually infected all of the decision making by the arbitrator.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I have two responses to that. One is the arbitrator did make lots of comments about the lack of notice that were not necessarily arrived at from the Constitution. The district was essentially telling the arbitrator, you need to add a forfeiture clause to this, basically to say if you lost your rights if you didn't ask soon enough. There's no authority for that in the contract. So the arbitrator was saying basically to the district, you can't ask me to add a forfeiture clause without you ever having said this is what we expect or what we want. So I think you framed it earlier as a fairness argument. This is, I think, a very good way to frame it. The other thing is that, you know, when you look at the decision page of the arbitrator, the first finding is on timeliness, the second two are about the duty and the failure to meet that duty, and the last is this constitutional reference. So our argument, Your Honor, is that it was not necessary to the decision. It could have been pulled, just like if you look at under the Uniform Arbitration Act, under 572B.24, there's specific language that authorizes someone in arbitration to request that the court correct an award. It's precisely in the situation where, and I'll give you the quote here, where it says the arbitrator has made an award on a claim not submitted to the arbitrator, and the award may be corrected without affecting the merits of the decision upon the claim submitted. And the appellant didn't do that here, right? They had that ability to ask for that correction or ask to have that pulled, and they didn't. But instead, they're asking for an even greater reward for the fact that the arbitrator happened to mention the Constitution or happened to have been so offended by their conduct that he referenced the Constitution.
And I Ms. Korhaus, can I follow up on that? I did notice the arbitrator seemed to do more than just a side comment. There's a heading, and I noticed on my reading the explanation, it actually comes before the heading on the interpretation of the contract, and the arbitrator devoted the equivalent of about a page or page and a half, perhaps, on the constitutional issue. Should that change our outlook in terms of, again, the phrase that Judge Gaitis was referring to, as Ms. Skelton did, the infection of the due process analysis?
I would say what infected his analysis was his perception of fairness, right? He, from the start, understood that this was someone who had earned a benefit and was being denied that benefit. And that constitutional analysis appears, that you're referring to, appears in the facts section. So that it talks about, right, that is how he considered the case that was brought before him. But then when it comes to his conclusions, he's very clear. He looked at the contract, he read the contract, he made a judgment on that based on the evidence in front of him. And then he also made a side note, arbitrators, they like to send messages to parties. And I think he was doing that. That message could be withdrawn and we would still have a conclusion on the contractual issue that was raised. So I don't agree that it infected his award. I also think that the remedy that appellant is seeking is out of line with the fact that there was a constitutional reference. So I think, Your Honor, you referenced earlier a per se violation. I mean, that's essentially what the appellant is asking for, is not that it be corrected, not that it, that even that we go back to the arbitrator and say, would you, you know, confirm for us you would still decide this without the Constitution. She's saying that the fact that he mentioned it means it needs to be thrown out, which is not what happened in either of the cases that they cite. They cited both McGrath and County of Hennepin versus LELS. And in both of those cases, the arbitrators was told, issue a decision based on our decision about what the Constitution means, right? The Constitution is set aside for courts to evaluate, but an arbitrator can take that court's decision then and incorporate it into his agreement. There is no authority, no precedent to say that an arbitration award should be overturned simply because there was a constitutional reference. Especially in this case where, I mean, both the district court agreed that this was something that was not, he did not need to make, and it did not, it could be, set aside. I think appellant accused us of trying to ask for a harmless error standard, and that's not it at all. What we are applying is the essence of the agreement standard, and he didn't exceed his authority by looking to the agreement for his decision in that matter.
Can I clarify, Ms. Courthouse, given the standard, let's assume the arbitrator had determined, using that same language that Ms. Skelton referred to, that because she did not retire, the 20 days had elapsed and the matter's done. Would you agree that if we were faced with that situation, the same standard, we would have to affirm simply because of the discretion? That would also not be an excessive authority by the arbitrator.
That's right, Your Honor. You know, and when Ms. Skelton started out her argument by saying that this was unusual, this is absolutely very unusual. And what's unusual about it is that the district would appeal. I mean, we have had lots of cases where we have received decisions we didn't like, and we live with it because that's what the parties have agreed to. We've decided we resolve our disputes in arbitration, and we live with them whether or not we like them. So you're right. If this had not come out in our favor, we would have lived with that decision and not been asserting that it was beyond his authority, because that is within his authority to make that decision. And as you know, we've talked about the standard of review quite a bit today, but every reasonable presumption in arbitration is in favor of the finality and validity of that arbitration award. And because the district court correctly held that the arbitrator's award drew its essence from the party's collective bargaining agreement, the district court's decision here should be affirmed. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Courthouse. And we will now set the timer for 5 minutes, Ms. Skelton, and you may provide rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a rare circumstance. Minneapolis Public Schools has certainly had arbitration decisions that it has disagreed with. And this is the first one that at least I have been involved in where we've sought to overturn an arbitration award. We agree with the respondent that the arbitrator had an opinion on this, and he dispensed his own brand of industrial justice in making the result that he wanted to happen. He was willing to make a constitutional determination. He was willing to ignore the language of the grievance timeline. He was willing to take off words from the wellness pay provision. The language of the collective bargaining agreement requires that the grievant retire, does not require Minneapolis Public Schools to give any kind of notice. And he manifestly disregarded the language of the CBA. Further, he manifestly disregarded the language of the collective bargaining agreement that required the grievant to be a teacher entitled to the benefits, and allowed this grievance to go forward when there was no authority to bring this grievance. So under the 1113 collective bargaining agreement that the arbitrator relied upon, the benefits available were only available to teachers. Teachers are defined as employees that are employed more than 14 hours a week, more than 68 work days per year. It's undisputed under that 1113 collective bargaining agreement that the grievant worked no hours, no days, was not defined as a teacher under that agreement, so was entitled to no benefits under the 2011-13 collective bargaining agreement. Further, And as stated in Adams versus Independent School District number 316, because she was no longer employed with Minneapolis Public Schools, she did not have access to the grievance procedure under the 1113 collective bargaining agreement, unless there was specific language under that agreement which allowed someone who was no longer employed with Minneapolis Public Schools to access that grievance procedure. The only language in the 1113 agreement relied upon by the arbitrator that referenced employees that were no longer with Minneapolis Public Schools involved employees that were laid off. And that language said that employees that were laid off only had access to the grievance procedure in order to contest their recall rights. In this case, the grievance was laid off, and this grievance did not involve recall rights. So she wasn't a teacher under the 1113 agreement that allowed her any benefits. To the extent that she was a laid off employee, the grievance procedure only allowed her to grieve her recall rights, did not allow her to grieve wellness pay. And therefore, the arbitrator did not have the authority to adjudicate this arbitration. And under Ide versus State Farm, because he did not have the authority to adjudicate this issue, he exceeded his powers and the arbitration award must be vacated. Your Honor, there is a very low bar for upholding an arbitration award, but there is a bar. And here, that low bar was not met. We would respectfully request, in this very unusual circumstance, based upon these very specific facts involving a constitutional determination, involving a past employee who comes forward 7 years later seeking a retirement benefit when she did not retire while she was an employee for Minneapolis Public Schools. It is true that the union filed a separation document 6 years after the grievant was no longer an employee of Minneapolis Public Schools, but that was too late. The grievant did not retire during the time period that she was employed with Minneapolis Public Schools. And ultimately, the collective bargaining agreement is reviewed in the same way as any other contract, and that the language of the collective bargaining agreement must be given effect. Otherwise, the collective bargaining agreement language and the agreement between the parties is deemed meaningless. And for all those reasons, this arbitration award must be vacated. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your extensive briefing as well as answers to our questions.